If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Elevate every morning with Tommy John's Second Skin underwear. The luxurious support of Second Skin guarantees everything will go smoothly. With over 20 million pairs sold and thousands of five-star reviews, guys love Tommy John. Plus, your most valuable assets are covered with Tommy John's best pair you'll ever wear or its free guarantee. Shop Tommy John's Friends and Family Sale right now and get 25% off site-wide at TommyJohn.com/Spotify. TommyJohn.com/Spotify. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Three great words, free fries Friday, especially when they're used in that exact order. Get a free medium fries with $1 minimum purchase.
Ba-da-ba-ba-ba. Valid one time on Fridays at participating McDonald's through 12/31/24. Excludes tax, must update rewards.
And welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. Recently, a news story broke about an extraordinary discovery excavated at Lindisfarne, the monastic site off the coast of Northumbria that started life in the mid-7th century. The find in question was a beautiful glass bead, which has been interpreted as a gaming piece. It's thought to date from around the period when Lindisfarne was famously raided by Vikings in the late 8th century. The find was made during a research project on Lindisfarne, jointly conducted by Durham University and Dig Ventures, a crowd-funded archaeology social enterprise. David Petz, Associate Professor of Archaeology at Durham, is the lead archaeologist on the project, and Lisa Wilkins is co-founder of Dig Ventures. History Extra's content director, David Musgrove, called David and Lisa to find out more. He began by asking David Petz to sketch out the story of monastic activity on Lindisfarne.
Yeah, Lindisfarne, as you said, it's a small island off the coast of Northumbria. It really, most people have heard of it because of the Lindisfarne Gospels, which are these amazing 8th century Anglo-Saxon illuminated Bible. And that came out of the Anglo-Saxon monastery that was founded on the island in AD 635. It was founded by the great Northumbrian king, King Oswald, he grew up in Western Scotland, and he probably converted to Christianity at Iona, which was a really important Irish-Scottish monastery. And when he became king, he came over with some monks from Iona. And yes, together they established this new monastery on an island. And it seems like he was really trying to create his own Iona in his new kingdom.
And you've written about this elsewhere, haven't you? That Iona, obviously on the west coast over in Scotland, and Lindisfarne on the east coast in Northumbria, but they both have that similarity of being an island within sight of the mainland. So there's a sense that that he was trying to recreate what he'd seen on Iona.
Yeah, and the important thing about Lindisfarne is it's just over the water from Bamburgh, which was is a major Anglo-Saxon palace site for the kings of Northumbria. So there's this nice kind of pair of a major ecclesiastical centre and a major power centre, and they look at each other across the water.
Okay, so the monastery is founded in the mid-7th century, and how long are things going on in Lindisfarne in a monastic sense for?
Well, so the monastery goes through the 7th century, the 8th century. Traditionally, the story is that the monks left in the mid-9th century because of Viking attacks, and the monks kind of took the relics and moved around northern England, ending up in Durham at the turn of the millennium. But it's increasingly clear from the archaeology and a reanalysis of the sculpture that actually there's probably some kind of continuity of the monastery all the way through to the point when the Normans kind of refounded a priory on the island at the end of the 11th century.
And that's kind of one of the key points, isn't it? People, when you go to visit Lindisfarne, I've been to Lindisfarne, it's an amazing place to visit, and anyone listening to the podcast, you try and get there if you can, it's fantastic. But the remains that you see there now, and they are ruins of the monastery that you see there, they aren't the Anglo-Saxon ruins.
No, yeah. As you said, if you go there now, you see this nice, small, compact medieval stone priory. But the underlying Anglo-Saxon monastery, it underlies that monastery. But also, it would have been much, much bigger. And we think it probably extended underneath almost all of the village and much of the surrounding area. It would have been this vast, sprawling establishment, very different from the compact medieval monastery.
Okay, we'll come back to it in a second. But one of the interesting things that you've made clear is that Lindisfarne, despite being pretty famous as an archaeological site and in the ecclesiastical history of Britain, has been a little bit under-researched in terms of archaeology. We didn't really know too much about this early monastery, and that's the project that you've been involved with to try and understand the nature of the Anglo-Saxon monastery and what it was like. And you've done it in association with this organisation called Dig Ventures. So perhaps you could talk a little bit about the way you've carried out this research and why you've worked in the way you have.
Yeah, the project, so it's a joint project between myself at Durham University and Dig Ventures, who are a fantastic organisation who really can promote and develop community archaeology, essentially. The project's been funded through crowdfunding and a little bit of money coming in through the university. And it's really important. Successful model for what we've been doing, trying to pull together and organise excavations nowadays. It's hard to find money. A lot of the traditional sources which academics have used to fund their work have become increasingly difficult to access. So we have to look at creative ways in which we can do our fieldwork. And I think increasingly we realise that most archaeologists working in Britain appreciate that when we're doing archaeological work, we need to work with local communities. And you know, if we're not doing the archaeology for the wider general public, then really why are we actually doing it in the first place?
And how hard is it to get permission to do a research excavation now? I mean, there's an understanding that excavation is destruction, and once you've dug something up, then people down the track aren't going to be able to do the same again. So that's been one of the impediments, I guess, for research over the past few years. How hard is it to actually get permission to do an excavation these days?
Well, there's really two kinds of permission you need. You need a permission from the landowner, obviously, because they don't want you digging holes in their land without permission. And also, if a site is a scheduled ancient monument, and that's a kind of a legal status, then you need to go to Historic England, who are the kind of national curators, and get permission through them. Now, we've been remarkably lucky with Lindisfarne, where actually the area we wanted to dig in is entirely unprotected in terms of heritage. All we needed to do was get the landowner's permission, and the local landowners have been incredibly helpful in facilitating us doing the work. So we've had it quite easy. But if you want to dig on a scheduled site, then there's obviously a heap more paperwork you have to battle through. And if you want to do that, you have to make a case that the research you do will kind of compensate for the destruction you do. So there's always a balance.
So Lisa, David and I were just talking about the model that that you've been working on to carry out this research excavation on Lindisfarne, and the fact that it's crowdfunded and community-led. So can you just give me a sense about how you go about setting up a Dig Ventures project, and how important it is to get community involvement?
Sure. Well, our projects come to us in different ways. Sometimes they're proposed to us by members of the general public, and sometimes someone like David will come to us with a fantastic site and a fantastic proposition. And in the case of Lindisfarne, you know, he'd been working there for several years and obviously has this really strong academic interest in the site, but needed some money and a dig team. So for us, I mean, when you're thinking about working in crowdfunding, having a story to tell is the most important thing. What you need to really do is capture public interest in the work that you're doing, because really, as David was saying, it's for them. And I think one of the things that certainly archaeologists have struggled with is being able to tell those stories in a way that people who aren't archaeologists feel that they can be a part of. So in setting up a Dig Ventures project, we always start from what's in it for the crowd. You know, we know what's in it for us as archaeologists. This is what we do. This is what we love doing. And we want to excavate that site. But how can we bring other people along with us? So in terms of the technical aspects, we have our own platform. So we're not using Kickstarter or Crowdfunder or anything like that. We run it all through our own website. And people can just come to Dig Ventures and see which projects we have running and which ones they feel motivated to be a part of.
And you're looking for volunteer involvement as well as financial involvement?
Yes, that's right. I mean, so it's a mixed model between crowdfunding, which is the financial aspect, and crowdsourcing, which is the experience aspect of it. And, you know, we are a Chartered Institute for Archaeologists registered organization. And that's really important to us because that's a quality control on the actual technical aspects of the fieldwork that we're delivering. So people come to us with sometimes no experience of archaeology whatsoever, but just this really intense fascination with the process and wanting to try it and be a part of it. Many of them have watched Time Team or have been inspired by, you know, mummies or some other form of archaeology. So they come to us and we train them on site. So our digs are very much training excavations and research-led excavations. Nothing that we do is the kind of archaeology that happens in advance of construction, and that's part of the planning process necessarily.
You've been digging in this really exciting place, in this beautiful holy island. What have you found?
We found all sorts of interesting things. In terms of our trenches, we can really divide our trench into two areas. One area, we've got a cemetery, and we've got an awful lot of burials coming up out of that area. On the other side of a trench, the side nearer the later priory, we've got a building. It's not a very impressive building. Anglo-Saxon structures can be quite ephemeral, but it's definitely there. And it seems to be associated with what we think is going to turn out to be an area of industry, metalworking, something like that. We've also got quite a lot of animal bone and seashells and things coming up from that area. So it may also have been used for cooking or food preparation at some point. So that's the kind of main areas. Within that, there's all sorts of things coming up. With our cemetery area particularly, we've started getting quite a number of what are called name stones, which are small stone burial markers, essentially. And they're of a form which are particularly distinct to Lindisfarne. And they're Anglo-Saxon, and they're great because they have the names of people, or bits of the names of people. They're sometimes a bit smashed up. But they're rather nice little insights into early medieval burial practice. We're starting to get a range of early medieval finds. Obviously, the glass playing piece, but we're getting coins. We're getting personal items. We've got a lovely pin. We've got a spindle whirl. All sorts of just bits of a typical daily life and death in an Anglo-Saxon monastery.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
Yeah, it's just lovely. It's only about, I don't know, 2 centimetres high. It looks almost like a kind of artisan boiled sweet. It's really, really delightful little thing. It's from a playing piece from a board game. And we know that there's all sorts of board games played in the early medieval world. The Irish have them, the Welsh have them, the Anglo-Saxons have them, and the Vikings have them. And they're all kind of broadly similar.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging, so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Elevate every morning with Tommy John's Second Skin Underwear. The luxurious support of Second Skin guarantees everything will go smoothly. With over 20 million pairs sold and thousands of five-star reviews, guys love Tommy John. Plus, your most valuable assets are covered with Tommy John's best pair you'll ever wear or its free guarantee. Shop Tommy John's Friends and Family Sale right now and get 25% off site-wide at TommyJohn.com/Spotify. TommyJohn.com/Spotify. See site for details.
Oh, such a clutch pickup, Dave.
I was worried we'd bring back the same team.
I meant those blackout motorized shades.
Blinds.com made it crazy affordable to replace our old blinds.
Hard to install?
No, it's easy. I installed these and then got some for my mom, too. She talked to a design consultant for free and scheduled a professional measure and install.
Hall of Fame son.
They're the number one online retailer of custom window coverings in the world.
Blinds.com is the GOAT.
The GOAT.
Go to Blinds.com for up to 45% off. Blinds.com. Rules and restrictions may apply.
And what have you got anything that gives precise dating to what you're finding here?
One of the challenges with dealing with the early medieval period is, particularly in the northern half of Britain, is there's quite a low number of objects. We don't have pottery, so you can't date things like that. Luckily, the coins do provide quite a good fix. So we certainly got 8th and 9th century coins. We're starting to use carbon 14 dating, and that tells us that we've got burials of the Middle Anglo-Saxon period, and also some of the burials are a little bit later, so they kind of go on into the Norman period. So they're the two main types of dating evidence we've got at the moment. And then of course we just look at parallels for our finds from other excavated sites, and that gives us a way of kind of taking bearings and working out what the dates are likely to be.
Okay, but you're not going back to the start of the monastic settlement here in the mid 7th century then? You haven't found anything that you would put there?
Not yet. I mean, obviously the way archaeology works is we start at the top, so we're working our through the more recent layers. Anything dating to the earliest period is going to be beneath where we are now. But there's no reason to think that as we go down, as we develop the project over the kind of coming years, that we won't be getting down into those very early layers.
And do we know where the earliest church is likely to be?
In terms of kind of parallels from other sites like this, it's most likely that the ecclesiastical focus of the site is where the later churches are. So on Holy Island, we have a big priory church for the monastery and a parish church. Those two are actually laid out in a line, but they've got the same axis, which is typical of Anglo-Saxon church planning. So we suspect that there's probably... the later structures replicate the positions of the earlier Anglo-Saxon structures. So I think the churches probably underlie, the earliest bits probably underlie the later churches.
Thank you. I guess we should, at this point, and you may not want to answer this, but you're using the terms Anglo-Saxon here and also early medieval, two terms that for some academics are interchangeable, but there is a debate about whether Anglo-Saxon is an acceptable term to be using these days. Do you have a view on that?
Yeah, this is a debate which particularly this year has become quite timely. Yeah, I mean, I've been using Anglo-Saxon just now. I must admit, it's out of habit. I've did my university degree over the last nearly 30 years ago. And when I was a student, we talked about the Anglo-Saxons, we write about the Anglo-Saxons, and it's a term which is widely understood by the general public. However, increasingly, and I think very fairly, people, particularly in the States, are realizing that the term Anglo-Saxon has been used in other ways, often which has kind of racial connotations. So it's something which archaeology and early medieval studies are increasingly chewing over, and there's quite an internal fierce debate about whether it's a term we should still be using. I'm trying to stop using it, but as I said, it's a habit. And I think this is one of the problems. It's people are so used to using it, and it's hard to find satisfactory alternate terms. But yes, it's something I think we need to at least be aware of the connotations and problems of using a phrase like that.
Of course. So we're using it advisedly here and with knowledge of the debate. And the fact that early medieval as a term probably doesn't mean that much to a lot of people.
Yeah, this is one of the troubles. Is a lot of people, and you talk about early medieval, and they think, oh, you mean the Normans. And it's trying to find a term which people understand for this period after the Romans and before the Norman conquest. You know, in 10 years ago, we were spending all our time trying to persuade people to stop calling it the Dark Ages, which I think we've largely won that battle. But there's a big difference between the terms we use within the profession as specialist terms and the terms which are understood by the wider public. Obviously, in northern England and southern Scotland, things are even more complicated because we're in a world where we don't just have the Northumbrians, but we've got the British kingdoms of places like Strathclyde. We have Irish kingdoms in western Scotland. We have the Picts. Central Britain is quite a multicultural place. So there's an awful lot of different cultural groups all swilling around, all interacting, all engaging with places like Lindisfarne. So it's we'll have to be a bit careful with terminology.
Yeah, complicated. And all these groups are engaging in lesser or greater ways with Christianity as well. And Christianity, of course, is the story here. So this monastic community that you're finding here from the late 8th century thereabouts, sort of the sort of things you're finding. It's a busy place. It's a bustling place. There's a lot going on. It's not, you kind of think of monks and monasticism as people just sat there, you know, cogitating and perhaps growing some swedes or something. But you're suggesting that there's a lot more going on than that.
Yeah, in early medieval Northumbria, it's basically a society without towns. There's no urban centres. But it's the monasteries which are really the biggest, most bustling places, the places with the largest permanent populations, because the kings themselves were generally moving around with their courts and not having one single permanent centre. So it's really the monasteries which are the places where we have monks, we have visitors, you have pilgrims, we have kings coming to visit. They're big, bustling places. And somewhere like Lindisfarne, as I said, we're just across the water from the major royal palace site of Bamburgh. The sea lanes are incredibly important. You know, in early medieval society, we know that people are going down to Europe. They're using the sea lanes to go south, and also they're using the sea lanes to go up north into Pictland. So it's actually quite an important place in the landscape. It's a place where people are passing through, visiting, and we think exchanging as well.
So does that slightly contradict? You've got this idea of St. Cuthbert is famously associated with the island, and one of the stories about him is he moves off to this smaller island, St. Cuthbert's Island, which is just off the edge of the main island, and to live the life of a hermit in some way. So super busy in one place, and then someone's trying to live an unworldly existence not far away. How do the two there come together?
Yeah, there's always this tension in monasticism between the communal life and the life of the hermit. Cuthbert goes. Yeah, he spends time on two different islands. St. Cuthbert's Island, which is just off Lindisfarne, and then he goes out to Innerfarne, which is about 3 or 4 miles further out to sea. And they're kind of paradoxical sites because St. Cuthbert's Island is, yes, it's a tidal island, but you know, when the tide's out, it only takes 2 minutes to walk over there. And actually, it was right next to what we think was the original route of the causeway to the mainland. It was overlooked by the monastery. Any hermit on the island would always have been observed. People would always be able to see them. People coming to the monastery would have walked straight past the island itself. And we know from writings about Cuthbert that when he's on Innerfarne, he got so fed up with people constantly coming over to visit him that he actually had to build up the walls of his cell so he wasn't so visible. So yeah, even when he's out on a kind of rocky island in the North Sea, he was still getting badgered and visited. And I think this is the thing about hermits. They're seen as holy. They're seen as having a special line to God. So people want to communicate with them. People want to actually use them as intercessors. People want to get prayers. People want to engage with them. And there's this constant struggle between them trying to find isolation and other people trying to find them.
So then going back to the things you found this beautiful blue glass gaming piece, which just looks so fantastic. It's been around the internet. Most people will have seen the images of it. Just what is that? What does that tell us?
Yeah, it's lovely. It's just lovely. It's only about, I don't know, 2 centimeters high. It looks almost like a kind of artisan boiled sweet. It's really, really delightful little thing. And yeah, it's from a playing piece from a board game. And we know that there's all sorts of board games played in the early medieval world. The Irish have them, the Welsh have them, the Anglo-Saxons have them, and the Vikings have them. And they're all kind of broadly similar. You find quite a lot of playing pieces for these kind of games, but they tend to be fairly simple things made out of worked bone or maybe a little bit of jet or a little bit of amber. The one we found is made out of glass. It's decorated glass. It's got these trails of white glass wrapped around the blue core. It's got little white beads on top of it. It's very much at the top end of these kind of objects. And it points to a shared culture around the North Sea, because, you know, the closest we have parallels from places like the Netherlands and Germany and Scandinavia. And probably the closest parallel is actually from a Pictish hill fort up near Perth. But the similarity between them suggests that there is this kind of shared elite culture, whether we're talking Vikings or Anglo-Saxons or Picts, and they are sharing the same kind of interests and pastimes, and that people who of that kind of social rank were also present on Lindisfarne.
And one of the news stories that came out about this suggested that it's a gaming piece from the Viking board game, and I'm going to mispronounce this, Hnefatafl. I don't know if that's correct.
Yeah, nearly. Hnefatafl, I think it is. Everyone pronounces it slightly differently. I mean, Hnefatafl is the version of the game that people are probably most familiar with if people have been to things like the Viking Centre in York or kind of watched the Vikings on television. They'll be aware of it. But it's just a whole series of other what are called Tafl games. And Tafl just literally means table or board. So yeah, they're all kind of subtle variations of a basic kind of board game. Yeah, our example, we can't be certain, but it's Viking, as in made or used by a Viking. Obviously there was a Viking presence at Lindisfarne occasionally, but it's certainly Viking age, Viking period. It fits into that chronological bracket.
Yeah, so as you're saying, there's a lot of cross communication and people traveling around this part of the world, not necessarily just with the sole intent of raiding and pillaging, and that doesn't immediately make a link to the famous Viking raids of 793 that are attested in the documents here, does it?
Yeah, absolutely. We know that the Kingdom of Northumbria was embedded into this North Sea trading world. So excavations at York have shown that Northumbria, because York was part of Northumbria, were trading with Flanders and northern Germany and places like France, and all sorts of goods were being traded on a reasonably substantial basis. And we think that places like Lindisfarne are plugged into that wider network of exchange.
And there's nothing that you've found in your excavations so far that is indicative of an actual raiding process. There's no burnt lair or skeletal remains with injuries or anything like that.
Yeah, I mean, we've got nothing which says Viking raid. And to be honest, it's very difficult to know what we would find, which would be absolutely definitive, because in a world where most buildings are built out of wood and the thatched, things burn down all the time. Equally, people are living, it's a rough old tough time. It's not just Vikings attacking, the Anglo-Saxons are fighting each other, the early medieval people are fighting each other. We know the place is raided by the Scots. So even if we did find somebody with a massive sword injury to the head, we wouldn't know whether it's a Viking sword or a Scottish sword.
Yeah. So really one of these name stones to say something like this man was killed by a Viking, that would help to clarify.
Yeah, we need something very, very explicit. So, yes.
it sounds like it's probably a little too early for where you've got to in your stratigraphy, but you've not found anything that would speak of the scriptorium, the place where these fabulous gospels that you mentioned earlier would have been made, because they would have been perhaps a little bit earlier than the timescale you've got to?
Yeah, I mean, broadly the same, at the earlier end of the period we're looking at. Yeah, I mean, we know that there's potential from other sites have found places where parchment have been made. There's a wonderful excavation up in Scotland called Port Mahomack, where they found a parchment making workshop. We know that, you know, other Anglo-Saxon monasteries, people have found things like styli, the little kind of pens for writing. So we found nothing definitive yet. Obviously, it's, you know, that would be our dream, is to find something directly connected to the Lindisfarne Gospels. One of the things we're hoping for the next couple of years is really at the end of our last season, we started to find what looks like it could be an industrial metalworking area. So, I mean, it's always a little bit cautious about making predictions about what we're going to find, but it would be lovely to find evidence for production of things like high status copper alloy work. We know the Gospels would originally have had a decorated cover, so evidence for production of kind of fittings and that kind of thing, which might have gone on a book cover, would be kind of on my bucket list at the moment.
Sure. And just a couple other things that come out of some of your other research on the island. You've mentioned in things you've written about this idea of a pilgrimage circuit around the monastery and around the island. Tell me about that.
Well, we there's been work done by another archaeological project on the island funded by the Lottery Fund, and they did a lot of work up on the Hjuf, which is the name for a rocky crag which overlooks the main part of the monastery. And they have found traces of what could be a church. There's some burials up there, and there's certainly at least two bases for crosses, which are probably Anglo-Saxon crosses. And that kind of links into some of the ways in which certainly particularly Irish monasteries are laid out with a kind of system of crosses and outside altars and locations where people could stop to pray. And it's possible that we've got something similar going on here. We have, you know, our best parallels for an archaeological site are with Iona. We know from Iona that as well as the monastery itself, they have hermitages and crosses beyond the confines of the monastery. And it may well be that people were making either individual circuits around this landscape of holy sites, or at certain times of the year, there were more formalized liturgical processions and ceremonies which involved this kind of movement round the landscape.
And there's also a reference to curse stones as part of this. What would they have been?
Yeah, this is something particularly found in more the Irish and Scottish traditions. These stones which were used for you just twisted them often on a cross base, and they would kind of leave these hollow marks. And the idea that you would, if you twisted them in the right direction, they'd be used to make a curse on somebody you didn't like. And there's some intriguing kind of impressions on one of the cross bases from Lindisfarne. And I mean, I've speculated that might be what we're seeing here, because we do have these strong links between Lindisfarne Christianity and what's going on further west.
Okay, so you're sort of describing quite a busy whole island here, then, with you know, quite a lot going on across the whole place. And you've got an interesting story that you mentioned about an entire wooden church being moved at one point. Tell me about how that happened.
Yeah, this happens at the point when after the Viking raids in the mid-9th century, some of the monks seem to move from Lindisfarne and they take a lot of the relics with them. They take, obviously, the relics of Cuthbert. But also on the island, it seems that one of the very early wooden churches associated, or at least associated in their minds by the mid-9th century, with one of the earliest abbots on the island. And that seems to have been preserved. And they actually physically, or later writings claim that they physically dismantle it and move the whole thing. And I think that's quite important, because it kind of suggests that they have this almost their own sense of managing their own cultural heritage. Actually, they've preserved this building and it's almost become a shrine in its own right. And it, because it's associated with some of the earliest phases of the monastery there. So taking it with them. It's a relic. It's a witness of those earliest phases of Christianity. They also claim to have taken one of the early stone crosses as well. So they're actually kind of, to a certain extent, dismantling some of the symbolic infrastructure of the monastery. And when the core of the monastery leaves, they take these things with them.
Okay, fascinating. Now, tell me this. So you've had a marvellous experience of digging and presumably you stay on the island when you're digging and really get a good sense of what it's like. If you are if you're just an average visitor coming along and wanting to have a look at Lindisfarne and explore it, what would you suggest that you do? Where what's the best thing to do to really get a sense of the history of the place?
I think there's three things. Have a look at the village itself. There's the remains of the priory and the visitor centre, and there's also another visitor centre run by the village itself. And they're wonderful opportunities to find out about the history of the Anglo-Saxon sites. It's worth walking out to the castle, which is the other side of the harbour, which is not a medieval castle. It's actually post-medieval, and then in the early 20th century, it was converted in the arts and crafts style to be a home, and it's just been restored by the National Trust, and that's really nice. But also, if you want to get a real flavour of the island, head out to the north side, away from all the tourists. And actually, if you can find them in the dunes on the north side of the island, there are traces of an early medieval farmstead at a site called Green Shiel. Once you get on the north side of the island, you've got the seals, you've got the seabirds, you've got the wind, and it's far fewer visitors. So that's probably a bit more of a touchy-feely experience side of the island.
One of the greatest things I found when I went there was just going towards St Cuthbert's Island and just standing there and listening, and I could hear seals barking around in the shallows nearby, which gives a real sense of the natural world there. So I imagine going there to dig must be quite a... Is it a different experience to digging in other excavations? Does it change the way that you approach it in any way?
Yeah, I mean, being on the island, I mean, it's an amazing opportunity to actually stay on the island for kind of weeks at a time. Obviously, because we're working with the tides, it means we have to kind of logistical, making sure that our workforce can get to the site every day, because not everyone stays on the island. But also it means that there's times when, I mean, it's a busy tourist place, so there's times when you're overwhelmed by visitors, but other times when the tide comes in, the visitors disappear, and it can be the middle of a day at the weekend and there's virtually no one there. So it's a very strange place to work. You get these kind of tides of visitors coming through and then just suddenly disappearing and leaving you kind of much more to yourself.
Okay, finally, what's next? So you've got some more seasons of excavation planned, I think.
Yeah, we're going to go back. We're going to keep on digging. Every year, with the stuff we're finding as we get more into the early medieval stuff, it's more exciting. The range of finds we're getting. I mean, this year it was all really nice stuff. As I said, we're on the edge of a possible workshop area, so that's going to be one of our priorities. But we've got all the human remains. We're starting analysing them here down in Durham, and nowadays we can not just say how old they were and what gender they were. We can start saying things like, look at diet, we can look at disease, we can look at even where they're coming from. So we're going to start developing some of that analytical side as well. So yeah, lots to look forward to.
So finally, just can you tell me where can we find out more about the excavation and the research project?
Well, we have a website through Dig Ventures. So the easiest way to find it is just to Google Dig Ventures and Lindisfarne, and they will find the webpage. And there's lots of pictures of the excavation, all the social media feeds, lots of information about what we're doing. And when we're out on site during the field season, we're constantly updating it kind of live as we go, so people can follow us in real time.
That was David Petz of Durham University and Lisa Wilkins of Dig Ventures. As David said, you can find out more about the project at digventures.com/Lindisfarne. There's also a wealth of content about Lindisfarne and the Anglo-Saxons and Vikings in general at our website. We've collected a load of material together for you at historyextra.com/Lindisfarne. Thanks for listening. Today's podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt and Jack Bateman. Tune in next on Friday when Francesca Wade will be discussing radical women in interwar Britain.